You know, if someone gets access to that server, they also now have access to the database and they can fan out their access. You can get to a point where like you can actually have an application automatically create database credentials that have a TTL set on them that say, okay, these credentials are only going to live for X amount of seconds or X amount of minutes or hours or whatever unit of time is, and then automatically go and fetch new creds. They're never stored on disk, things like that. That's a way more secure system.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%.
GM, everyone. My name's Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits. And today, I'm with Max Kaplan. How's it going, GM?
Yo, what's going on?
Not much. Here with you, finally. Very excited to talk all of the Solana and the past you've been in. Just for some background, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me. Excited to be here. You know, listen to a few of your episodes. They're awesome, man. And really excited to talk today. So my name is Max, currently working at a company called Ajavana, leading engineering there. I've been in crypto, I'd say the first time I bought crypto was in 2014, but, I didn't really get super into it until really early 2017. Like, I remember buying Bitcoin back in 2014 and, being interested in it, but, there's kind of like buying crypto and then kind of falling down the whole rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And I remember in, early 2017, just reading this article about Bitcoin and got just like super into it to the point, where, I was working at a job then and I just like couldn't focus on anything else, like my day job, except crypto. So really started going deep down that rabbit hole. And, eventually I started doing some like really, really minor like open source stuff and things like that. Keep in mind, this is like early 2017 where there really wasn't like a lot of crypto companies, but I posted something on Reddit and Kraken actually reached out to me and they were saying, hey, I never thought in a million years I'd be saying I got a job off Reddit, but they reached out to me and they're like, we're hiring. And, I think you'd be good for this role. And, at the time, there was like maybe only a few companies you could like work full time in crypto and like actually make a decent living and get paid in dollars and, things like that. But, went through that process and got worked at Kraken and, happy to dig into that. But, now I'm at Ajavana and that's a good high level overview of myself.
Hell yeah. And what did you do at Kraken? How did you transition into going to Kraken? What were you doing there? You told me you're managing a large team in the early days and saw it scale while on the inside. So how was that experience, first of all?
Yeah, absolutely wild, man. Some of truly like the best times I had, definitely in my professional life. But, just to start, I kind of got hired on as a normal dev, and funny enough, it was actually, I had been doing some mobile stuff before that. It was, it was a little bit like full stack. But I got hired as, believe it or not, a mobile engineer to start. And,
so random.
Yeah.
Okay.
So random. Yeah. It got put on pause. And then I was like part of the front end team, but like that wasn't like, the best fit for me. I really like found myself like getting into like CI/CD pipelines and, like all this stuff. So then I started working. I'll kind of keep this like medium version. I took over a team called, I really took over the data team at Kraken and I led that for a number of years. And, you can imagine like at a crypto company, from like 2017 to 20, like 2020, 2021, the amount of data Kraken like was getting was just like growing by orders of magnitude. Yeah. What we were trying to do, like, in the stack we had just like did not scale. And, keep in mind too, that like, people know Kraken as, like a very big company and they are, and they're awesome. But like every company starts small and, like our stack just wasn't scaling. So, I built out this whole new data stack. Then really that, because I basically rewrote that whole stack, I ended up taking over the whole DevOps team at Kraken. And, I led both data and infrastructure at Kraken for a while. And I think it was up to like, 60 or 70 people I was leading for quite a bit for a number of years, and it was awesome. Big fan of Kraken. We had a great time, and that's what I was really doing there.
So I don't think this is a very common occurrence of managing, 70 people. For the people that don't actually know what that's like, Can you explain that? And I guess, how do you even get to the level where you can do that and be a good leader as well?
Yeah, what a fantastic question, man. So it changed so much, I would say from like, when you're managing a team, like when you first become a manager, you're really managing a team of, maybe like 3, 4, 5, 6 people, right? And, at that level, it's really about, like making sure people are empowered to, do their jobs. People are empowered to make decisions. You're obviously like, everyone manages differently and there's no right way to manage people. But my motto was always give people a lot of power. Let them make mistakes. They'll learn. I would never want to be that person that was like micromanaging someone, like approving PRs, things like that. Just like really giving everyone this like really big sense of entitlement and power. Mm-hmm. When I did that for a number of years, and then I got to a point, as Kraken was growing, all of a sudden I'm managing like 14 people, and it's easy, if there's like engineers on the call listening, you can kind of picture a manager, I, at least for me, I always picture my manager of just like being super in the weeds, in the code. And I don't want to say like super in the weeds, but thinking about like what this person should work on and that. But there's so many HR issues that come up too. And then you have like your manager making sure that, the priorities, and you got to go and make sure that other teams in the company know like what you're doing, because if you're building something cool, the marketing team has to know, the compliance team might have to know, and things like that. Right. Going circling back to what you're saying, then you eventually get to a point of managing managers, right? Yeah. Because you can't manage 20 people effectively. Like my line usually is around the 6 to 10 mark. Right. You basically need to start managing managers. And at that point, it really becomes like, the way you manage managers, and this is my opinion, is how well they're growing talent within the company. Basically because, I'm sure, like a lot of people listening are at a company and, there's probably like one person at that company that just knows like every detail about the stack, and like there's a lot of other like really smart people, who are there and like they know like a lot of cool things, but every company has like their way of doing things. Like there's like always this like one person or handful of people that just like happen to know everything and like why certain decisions were made and things like that. It's when I was managing managers, it was really about making sure we grew that out just so that like the company could move faster and things like that. So I think the answer is like it really depends upon how many people you're managing, but really, I guess that's the answer to your question.
Management is such an important thing because you can have such a fantastic superstar team, and if they're not managed properly or the communication is all wrong, someone's doing something and then they pivot or they keep doing that and there's no real focus, or then it all crumbles. It's like having the Golden State Warriors in their prime, but they're all like solo stars and not gelling together. Like an average team that gels together would do better if they were managed properly, right? And I've seen this countless times. I was part of a lot of these teams, and it's the management is really bad. It just like crumbles and burns. So it is like a really hard skill because it's also engineering, but at like the social level. And that's kind of what CEOs get to. It's like actually instead of building code, you build teams containing people, and it's just like a higher form of leverage the higher you go up. And then you get to like countries and like running armies, and it's the exact same thing except there's more people to kind of command. But it's I guess everything can be seen as like that, which is why I asked like how can people get better. Like there's a leadership is a very tough thing to get good at, but when you have someone that's a great leader, it can really like move mountains very effectively. And there is like, I remember seeing this quite recently. It's, if you're doing a startup or any kind of team management, you want to focus on the people instead of the products, like the numbers, because if the people that are creating the numbers are happy, then the numbers are going to come regardless, right? Instead of micromanaging the numbers and not caring about the human's feelings and, are you getting burnt out? Is this something you enjoy? If not, then they're going to crash and burn, and the numbers will reflect that anyway. So focus at the source, the root of it, instead of the surface that are causation of, the person creating it, really. At least, that's like that's a major thing I see in startups, at least, and it's a determining factor of whether you succeed or not. at the end of the
Absolutely, man. Couldn't agree more. And, you know, I mean, so much of it too is making sure that, you know, everyone is happy as well. You know, like especially, you know, especially the like the strongest contributors, you know, because, you know, a company is really just a collection of different people, right? Yeah. And you need to have the best team. Like, you know, like, listen, like if you want to win, you need to have the best team, right? And, you know, making sure that your best people are happy, that's, in my opinion, like probably the most important thing you could do as a manager, right? You know, maybe like the second thing is, you know, really making sure they're working on something that they really want to work on within reason, of course. You know, like obviously, you know, I'm an engineer myself. Like there's things I want to work on that like probably just don't have like, you know, any value to like, you know, wherever I might be, you know, working on. Like I think all of us engineers are just like intrinsically interested in just like different topics, yeah, right? But, you know, within reason, you know, and then, you know, eventually you kind of get to this point too where you realize, and this is kind of like, you know, listen, there's pros and cons to being a manager, but you know, eventually, like once you start managing a lot of people, you kind of get to this point where you realize your time is better spent not focusing on anything technical at all. It's a complete, you know, it's completely better spent by like trusting the people that you have to do a great job and making sure that they're happy, they're successful, and the business understands what they're working on. 100%. And, you know, and at that point, that's like the point where you get to where like you realize you've done a good job, in my opinion, right? But it's also the point where like, at sometimes you can be like, man, I might just have to spend my next week just making PowerPoint presentations or you know, something like that, you know, just to keep the team excited or, you know, let other people know what you're working on, things like that. But, you know, there's clearly pros and cons to it, but it is definitely very interesting. It's very different as well.
100%. I think the personalization of teams as well, becoming friends of them or at least professional friends in some sense. If you have a good relationship with someone, and it's very strong, you become friends and whatnot. Like I've personally done this as well, where I've become friends, like very good friends of the people I work with. And I would actually just do, you know, all nighters because I don't want to let them down because they're the homies and they treat me well. Yeah. And that's like something you wouldn't get out of someone if you were micromanaging them. Like the willingness of like, you don't have to, but they will go an all nighter just to get something done or go the extra mile because, you know, you're nice to each other, basically. So there is a lot of benefits to not being like robots and trying to remove the human from the equation, really.
Yeah, absolutely, completely agreed. And, you know, one of the things like I always prided myself on, you know, like that I never wanted to get to was like, if there's a problem, like I'm not going to be the one that just goes and messages someone and be like, hey, you know, Bob, like make sure you get this done. You know, like, listen, if you need help, I'm rolled up my sleeves. I'll get in there with you. And if you're working till 11 p.m., so am I. Right. Like, you know, like that, I think is like a really important trait, you know, like, listen, things suck and I'm happy to be the one scrubbing the floors. Like, doesn't matter. We're all here to solve a mission. And, you know, if you can do that for someone, you know, that you're managing, they'll do that for you too. And like, I think that's just such a crucial trait.
Of course. What do you think were like major contributors to, let's say, like, to Kraken actually scaling from, you know, 100-person company when you were there to 3,000?
Yeah. You know, it's a lot, right? You know, like I think like, you know, if I'm being honest, you know, again, these are my opinions, right? Yeah. But yeah, you know, I mean, right place, right time is number one, right? So, you know, Jesse Powell, you know, like I know he's one of the coolest people, and you know, I mean, the guy quite literally changed my life, right? So, you know, Jesse had a great vision. Jesse's a great leader himself, and you know, he founded a company at the right time, did all the right things. But listen, like, you know, Kraken was, you know, I don't know if a lot of people realize, but Kraken was founded super early, like, you know, before Coinbase and before almost every exchange, really, right? Mm. And, you know, it survived Gox, like it survived like all these different events that happened. And, you know, Kraken, like we always said, like we were a security company first and then like an exchange on top of that, right? And everything at Kraken was about security, like every single like little detail, to the point where like it was almost like at some points annoying, but it was all these little things, like these little things like that add up. So, you know, I would say like right place, right time, definitely the attention to security. As a centralized exchange, there's a lot at risk, obviously. And Kraken does everything so right there in terms of that, you know, and also just offering good products too that, you know, people want to use. But also, I mean, listen, like, I think I'd be lying if I said when I joined in 2017, you know, like if I asked like 10 people on the street what Bitcoin was, like this was before the bull run, probably like five of them would say like, yeah, I've heard of it. Now Bitcoin, you know, in the overall crypto industry is way bigger, right? So that certainly helps as well. So that's what I would say.
Okay, interesting. And then when you decided to leave, what were you doing in that transitioning period before you got into the place where you are now?
Yeah, definitely, man. So, you know, like I said, you know, there's certainly like pros and cons to managing, you know, but, you know, kind of what I was alluding to was, you know, like at, you know, at a certain point, you get to a point where, you know, your time is better spent, I think, just like focusing on the team and things like that. And listen, like that's always fun. And, you know, when things go well, it's so rewarding and
right.
You know, you love seeing people happy and things like that. But, you know, at the same time, you know, we're all humans, right? And I describe myself as an engineer, right? Like I'm never the type of person that would like, you know, go on the street, you know, if someone asks like, what do you do? Like, or be like, oh, like I'm a manager of 60 people. No, like I always say like, I'm a software engineer, right? Or DevOps engineer, yeah. You know? So like, I, you know, and I got to this point where, you know, like, and, you know, I would say like, of the people kind of like at my so-called level, I was definitely always the most like hands-on, maybe, you know, like top two, top three. But there's kind of like the saying, like, you know, eventually like, you got to like hang up the keyboard and, you know, like into management and stuff. And I just wasn't ready to do that, man. There's so much cool stuff going on in crypto. And, you know, I mean, you know, I was working at a, you know, a centralized exchange and I was really, really interested in trading, you know, and I'd been working in trading for 6 years. And, you know, a lot of these like high performance blockchains started coming out and, you know, especially Solana. So I got like really interested in that. And, you know, I just started like going deeper and deeper in the weeds. And I'm like, okay, like, I want to be in Solana. You know, I come from a DevOps background and, you know, like validators was like always something I was really interested in and,
nice.
You know, just like how chains work. And then like, I just went down this rabbit hole. I was like, all right, I got to work in Solana. And here I am.
How did you break into Solana? Because when I was trying to do it a year or two ago, it was just impossible. Well, to be fair, I think I just didn't try hard enough because now I've done it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a completely different from Ethereum. But once you get into it, just like anything else, like we can learn anything. So how was it breaking into it? What was your strategy? And did you go straight to the validator, start doing stuff there, deploy it? Well, tell me about it.
Yeah, definitely, man. You know, so like my train of thought was like more around like, I mean, listen, like everyone, you know, there's problems with centralized exchanges, right? And my thinking was like, you know, like, let me go and start like, you know, messing with like, you know, some DEXs, right? So like, you know, I get to Jupiter and I'm like, okay, cool. Like, damn, like this actually works. Like, you know, and I'm like, even from like a consumer point of view. And I have this friend and it's going to be funny if he listens to it. But, you know, I have this friend. He's like a really good friend. Like I've known him since middle school, right? And like, he's not someone that like you would expect, like he's not an engineer at all. Like, you know, this is like a friend I've known for a while, but you know, like, and like, I was telling him like, you know, you should get in crypto, like, really like early on, like he was like, dude, like I'm not using that like magic internet money, right? And you know, like last year he's like, he starts telling me about Solana and like how easy it is to use, and I'm like are you kidding me, man? Like I never would have expected you to like be using like a blockchain. He's like, oh yeah, like, you know, like, I'm using Phantom and all this stuff. So like my first thought process was like, all right, like let me go and, you know, like see the trading experience, right? And is it good enough, right? So like I'm using it, I'm placing trades, and I'm like, okay, cool, this is actually like really awesome. And you know, on Ethereum it's not the best, right? You know, I mean, you know, now it's like a little bit better with L2s and stuff, but mm-hmm. You know, I mean, on Solana it was super cheap and super fast, where like on Ethereum, you know, you could pay at sometimes like $50, you know, just for like a really small trade. And you know, I never really took that seriously. So I get through Jupiter, I'm like, okay, cool. And then like I'm really interested in like how liquidity works, right? You know, I mean, centralized exchanges are, you know, based upon market makers and, you know, order books, you know. So I'm like I'm reading about this, like, you know, like all these different like AMMs and things like that. I'm like, damn, this is so interesting, right? So I'm like, okay, like I'm convinced there's something here. And like, yes, there's problems, like, you know, we have MEV, you know, we have things like that, right? But like, let me, so then I dug into validators and, you know, I spun up a validator. I'm like, all right, now I'm in this. And you know, listen, like I poked around in the code and things like that. And, you know, like have some contributions, but that was kind of really my path into getting into it. I started kind of at the top in terms of like, right. Is this an experience that like users can use today? And then it was more like, okay, I think it is. How does this work? And that's kind of, you know, where I'm at and, you know, where I continue to be and, you know, trying to make that work.
Definitely. And so you basically just spun up a validator, put it onto a box and just messed around with the code, or just... How did you go about this to get to a point where you're at now? You mentioned that you made some commits on like Fire Dancer and Agave. I hope I'm not butchering that once again. But yeah, what was it like interacting with like these different validator clients?
Man, yeah. Well, and first of all, I got to say like really, really small commits. Like, you know, they're not documentation commits. You know, and like, again, my background is like more of a DevOps engineer. They're not documentation commits, but they're not like core protocol commits either, right? So I want to make that clear too.
It's a commit.
Yeah. It's a commit, right? So like they're more operational. Like at least on Fire Dancer was like some flags were in like parsing properly. And, you know, like all of a sudden, like, you know, one of my disks was filling up and it was because like there was like an accounts flag or something, you know, like to map it, to store the accounts like somewhere, but it wasn't being parsed properly. And, you know, like, you know, so like it was more like stuff like that, you know. But, you know, listen, so FireDancer, man, that is one hell of a repo. And those guys are doing an awesome job over there. You know, and it's been like a few months since I've messed with FireDancer personally. But, you know, at Ajvada, I'm pretty sure we had the first ever FireDancer validator on testnet that lived for like more than a day, right? Like there was someone at Breakpoint that I think spun up a FireDancer validator. Like I'm not trying to take anything away from him or them. I don't know who it is, right? But you know, I think we were like the first one that spun it up, and you know, someone please correct me if I'm wrong, but the first one that like had it running for more than a week, you know, and I published a blog post about like how to run it, and we published an Ansible playbook so other people could run FireDancer. I'm really excited for that, especially in terms of like the benefits it can bring and just the overall idea of it. It's just like super fascinating with like what they're doing. But you know, we've been running Jito for a while and those guys are awesome. I talk to those guys a lot, and you know, Jito has really changed validator economics, I would say, and that's probably a whole different rabbit hole as well. You know, I don't like, you know, not like majorly, but definitely materially, especially with like what's going on in the MEV world. And then you obviously have like the OG, the Labs client, which is now named Agave, and you know, that one is pretty straightforward, I would say.
Okay. I'm actually curious, what do you think, how do you actually become a good DevOps engineer? I've never really dabbled in DevOps at all, and I have not that experience in it. So what actually is DevOps? How do you get good at it? And how do you determine whether someone is good or bad?
It's such a good question, right? And DevOps is such an overloaded term. You know, like there's like in the DevOps world, people say that DevOps isn't a job, but like an SRE is. And DevOps is more kind of like a methodology, right? But let me answer your question. It really depends upon the type of company that you're at, right? So like there's kind of like two camps if you were to ask two different people like what DevOps is. There's like one of them that's, you know, DevOps is really there to make engineers go faster, right? And that's about like, you know, making sure you have super fast CI/CD pipelines that, you know, like when someone's committing code, like, you know, you want to measure like how fast it goes from committing code into like a branch to like getting into production. And like, you know, there's many steps in between there in terms of like, you know, a commit to going to like some dev environment to then going to some UAT environment and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And like, this gets exponentially harder, like the more developers there are. Like at Kraken, for example, there's 800 engineers, right? So like, you know, you can't just go and say like, you know, all these people are committing code. Like you can't just like, you know, someone just can't raise their hand and be like, hey, yeah, I'm going to take over like the dev environment, like, you know, for the next, you know, 4 hours, you know, otherwise, you know, the company, you know, would just come to like a screeching halt, right? And then there's kind of like this other side too, which is like about reliability, latency, you know, kind of, you know, like all these like core metrics, you know, that like are really business facing. You know, that kind of like a controversial opinion I always have is that, you know, like there's like a lot of times I got asked like, you know, like how do you manage, like how do you measure how good an engineering team is, right? And like the first things that always came to my head are like throughput, latency, availability. Okay. Those are like definitely metrics that like all the engineering team is like focused on. Okay. Because it's like, okay, you can have like the best DevOps stack, but like, you know, if your stack is written in, I don't know, like some interpreted language like PHP or something like that, like, you know, like it doesn't matter what you're doing in terms of like all the networking stuff that you're doing, your code's going to be slow, right? You know, overall, what I actually view it as is that like engineering metrics and business metrics are actually the same thing, right? Like you could say like, oh, like, you know, let's pretend like we have some company and, you know, we're targeting 3 nines of availability. Okay. Like that's great if you're hitting it. And that means like your engineering team is doing awesome. But like to hit 3 nines of availability, you need people like on call that are like in front of a keyboard if something breaks, right? And at some point is like, you know, if you only have like 10 users, is it worth it to be paying people, right? To be sitting at their keyboard being on call, right?
Right.
So, but like to get like a little more technical, like really like the stuff I was working on really was like, you know, containers, like low level optimizations, you know, like kind of like Kubernetes, Nomad, orchestration platforms, then security, but even getting into like, you know, just some simple things, like when you're running like a really large microservice environment, like, you know, picture thousands of microservices, especially if like you're really focused on security, you know, you want all those things to be, you know, talking over like MTLS and things like that, you know, and you want to be able to provision those certificates, like, you know, you want them to be like super short lived, and you want them to be provisioned, you know, like in a way that's incredibly fast, you know, because, you know, someone as who's a developer, you know, if like they're waiting, you know, they got to put in a ticket to be like, oh yeah, please make me some, you know, TLS certificate, you know, like, you know, they'll be waiting hours, you know, especially in like a remote company, being able to like provision all these different things, and like also making sure that your stack is up, your stack is fast, you have metrics, things are measurable, things like that. That's what I would consider. You know, also the engineering team is moving fast. That's what I consider what makes a good DevOps engineer.
And what actually made you get into this? It seems like DevOps is primarily used for when companies scale.
Yeah.
That's my perspective. It could be wrong.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting to. As you were saying, like if you have 800 engineers and everyone's committing or wanting the testing environment, then you're going to manage that somehow. And that's when DevOps seems like a prime, you know, essential for a company. Why did you get into this instead of going full software engineer instead?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good question. I never expected myself to get into it because I started off as a software engineer. But, you know, like when you're a software engineer, you can write like, you know, I mean, like, listen, like a lot of code bases, like, okay, like you're going to need an API, you know, you're going to need to connect, you know, like Web 2 worlds, right? You're going to need to connect to a database, you know, you're going to do that, like all these sorts of things. And you're like probably like 99% of all code bases out there, like you could kind of say are somewhat similar in terms of like, okay, they have an API, they're connected to a database, you know, doing all this stuff. And like, yeah, right. But like, you know, like the 1%, probably less than that, of like doing like system level optimizations, like that part is like definitely interesting to me. But, you know, when you're talking about like, okay, cool, when you start getting like, when you start doing a lot with like really big distributed systems that like are pushing a lot of data through it, you really need to think about things like fault tolerance, things like that. And you know what, like, the way I always describe like why I like DevOps is that like it's kind of like weird, but you know, things break all the time in terms of like different systems and like getting different systems to talk to each other. You're always touching like really new technology as well. And like, you know, like this whole idea of like getting systems to talk to each other and also making sure that like, you know, like if there is some sort of fault in the system that it's going to recover very quickly, that is incredibly interesting to me for whatever reason. You know, it's like there's never a day that's the same in DevOps. It's like, you know, like something will break, or, you know, and like, listen, like it, like another part of DevOps too is if something breaks, like that doesn't mean like something is down, right? Like, and that's like the point you want to get to where like, okay, cool. Like, you know, like if you, let's just talk about like a database, for example, just like, you know, hypothetical example. But, you know, like if you have like a database and the database goes down, okay, cool. Like if you only have one, that's like a big problem. But if you have a load balancer in front of databases and one of those goes down, okay, great. Like, you know, your application, you know, is talking to a load balancer, all the traffic just gets forwarded out to a different load balancer and that database breaks and, you know, you got to go and fix it. But like, cool, all your customers are happy. Life goes on, right? There's never a day that's the same in DevOps, and like kind of getting like all these systems in a way where that, like, you know, they can be fault tolerant and they recover quickly. That's what's very interesting to me.
What are like the security implications of this? So let's say something does go down or something breaks. Is there anything, is it like you have to act super quickly, or is it very critical if it goes down and there's a time period between it going up and down? Yeah. What are like the security concerns? And is it like ever a race to like fix it? Have you ever had any like people trying to break in while it's down? Tell me about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, security is such a critical thing, and there's definitely things like you don't want to automate, right? Like, just going back to that hypothetical example, you know, like if you're a financial company and you're storing, you know, balances in a database, right? Like unless you're partitioning in some sort of right way, you have to be really careful about failing over something like a database automatically, because that's something that can't really be treated like a web application. That has to be treated more like rocket science, like basically just like a smart contract or a Solana program has to be treated, right? In terms of security though, like a lot of people get like really nervous about that, like automation of things, but I actually think it can actually make things a lot better because of the way of like, okay, if something is like, you know, like at the end of the day, like if things are like certain things are done manually, humans are involved, right? And, you know, they're going to make mistakes. Things aren't going to be documented, things like that. If you can get to a point where like you're automating, like for example, like TLS certificates, that's probably like a really easy one to talk about, right? Like when a TLS certificate is created, code is going to go and create that. It's always going to be done the right way. And then you could also go and trigger alerts to your security team that something, you know, that was created. And also from those alerts, if you get alerts, like, you know, within some sort of hook system, anytime like a new certificate is created and like you see something weird, because you have those alerts, like you're actually alerted to the fact that someone might have actually done something that like wasn't supposed to be done. Whereas like if you don't have this automated system that's actually pushing logs and things like that, you don't get any records of that, right? And actually detecting a breach is an incredibly difficult thing to do, as like, you know, someone with your background, like you probably knows. So if you have these systems automated, I actually think it makes things a lot better.
How do you actually automate this? Because I know that's what you're doing at Javana, right? You're automating deployment of validators. Is that correct?
Yes, we definitely are. There's a lot that we're doing here, you know, in terms of like other things as well. But this side, like, you know, I think we're getting like super technical here. But in terms of, which is good, this is like, I love this stuff.
Sorry,
exactly, right? But like, you know, in terms of automating, like there's a lot of tools out there that'll do, like, you know, so like, for example, like probably the best one to like automate TLS certificates is something called HashiCorp Vault. But it gets even deeper than that too. Like even just like think about the concept. So, you know, like HashiCorp Vault is like really good, for example, at provisioning TLS certificates. But like even think of something like more like database credentials, okay? A lot of developers here like might go and, you know, just be like, okay, cool. Like my application needs to go and connect to a database and I'm going to go and maybe get those creds and stick them in an ENV file on a server or something like that. But like that's a huge risk in itself, okay? Like, you know, if someone hacks into that server, you know, and those creds are sitting there like on disk, you know, if someone gets access to that server, they also now have access to the database and they can fan out their access and, you know, they could do all sorts of stuff. You can get to a point where like you can actually have an application automatically create database credentials that have a TTL set on them that say, okay, these credentials are only going to live for X amount of seconds or X amount of minutes or hours or whatever unit of time is, mm-hmm. and then automatically go and fetch new creds. They're never stored on disk, things like that. That's a way more secure system, so long as you're actually securing the access to what can actually go and do those things and securing the access that those database credentials that can be automatically generated, like they have the least privilege access. You know, like, so if something doesn't need read access, something doesn't need write access, there's no reason that like you should just do like create user with all privileges, right? You know, it's like, no, it better be super nitty gritty, only has read access to the tables it needs, things like that. And like, you know, all these different things that like developers kind of do that are like more opsy, you could automate all this stuff and actually make it like way more secure.
Interesting. So speaking on the topic of automation with DevOps, how do you see AI being a contributor to this automation pipeline? How do you think things will change over time in the future of DevOps with you know, AI coming in, not just like LLMs, but I mean like, you know, let's say, I don't know, just something that it's obviously a new paradigm, right? It's a revolution in entire of human history, and when it's actually gets to a point where we have like a big bang of just agents on the internet. How do you think this is going to affect everything, and especially DevOps?
Yeah, definitely. Well, AI is obviously big, right? But in terms of how I think it's going to affect DevOps, it's going to be something like this, where, you know, like you're at a company, you want like, you know, obviously every tech company doesn't want to go down, right? You know, like that's something everyone wants to avoid, right? So like, you know, like usually like when a company goes and starts on like their alerting strategy, it's like, okay, like, you know, if a database goes down, I better be alerted about it. So, and like when you're configuring that alert, like when a database is down, like, cause like, you know, a lot of people, like a lot of companies out there, they probably won't have any idea when a database goes down or something like that. Right. And then like, the problem is like, if you don't get an alert, okay, your downtime could be extended because no human knows that like a database is down and someone's got to go and fix it. Okay. Then you get to this point of like, okay, you've kind of solved all of that. We want to start like preventing failures. Okay. So like, you know, like, and again, like if you're talking about like a database, like, you know, there's certain metrics you can start to look at where like, if something starts to rise, you can say, okay, cool. Like this metric isn't looking great right now. Let me go and like throw an alert about this, but you're not actually down at that point. Right? Like you're getting an alert before you're down and you could start solving, like you could start, like you actually have time to actually go and prevent that outage. That's like a very good place to be at, like as like a DevOps engineer, like if you're able to get alerts like that. But like to answer your question on AI, a lot of those insights are like really difficult to get to, right? Because, you know, like, and for whatever reason, we're talking about like Web 2 technology right now, but, that's cool. AI can like, you know, like it takes like a lot of like, incidents to find like these metrics, like these hints of like, okay, this went up like the last three times we hit it, you know, like we hit a downtime, right? And like, you know, humans have to go and like parse through this data, right? And find that. But like AI can actually help with that. And like, you know, kind of the short answer to the short answer to your question is that like for DevOps, AI, I think can really help like companies know before they're about to have an incident by like looking at a whole bunch of different data, kind of finding anomalies in that data, setting up alerts for that, and then, you know, being able to trigger faster to alert someone so they can make whatever changes needed. Boom, done. We fix something before something went down, before something goes down.
Right. So you can do like a kind of alert system that it like gains an intuition of how something would go down.
Exactly.
Give you an alert of like how to fix it as well, and then you just go do that instead of just getting the error message of like, oh, it's down, by the way.
Exactly. Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of what I'm alluding to there.
Interesting. So tell me more about the Solana, Solana platform for validators.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on at Jvana. So like really the way most people know us as is we're a bare metal provider for Solana validators. I think right now at this moment in time, the last I checked, I think it was somewhere around we had 12 million SOL staked by our own clients. You know, like, and when I'm saying that, like, validators are our customers. The set of those customers have about 12 million SOL stake on their own servers, right? We also have, you know, an automation platform, which is kind of in more of like a closed beta-ish right now that, you know, people can go and click a button to spin up a validator. But, you know, then we're also doing some more technical things. So, you know, one of the things that we're doing is we have a liquid staking token called EdgeSol, for example. And we have a whole delegation strategy for that. One of the reasons we're doing that is because we want to incentivize, you know, other validators to go and run on Jvana. And, you know, I mean, listen, validators are businesses at the end of the day. And what makes them more money at stake, right? You know, they get more block rewards, you know, things like, you know, they get more in MEV, they get more leader slots, things like that, right? You know, if we can, you know, if EdgeSol gets, you know, continues to grow and things like that, we can actually go and stake to our validators, right? Which gives us another reason to go run on Jvana. And we're also like helping them as well, right? You know, we want to help our customers as much as possible. That's one of the things where we've been really focused on for the past few months as well. And I'd say probably like, you know, 2 or 3 months there. But then we run validators as well on behalf of other clients. And we run a validator ourselves that has about like 400,000 SOL. So we're really deep in like the validator side.
Yeah.
And I should say like the staking side, like I guess like at a higher level where is where we're at.
Right, yeah, the stake weight quality of a service, right? The QoS.
Yes, so that's a new concept. Well, I shouldn't say new concept, but that's definitely something that's gaining a lot of steam in the community. That's for sure, and I think it's going to be more important. We're definitely doing stuff there, and I think that's going to be. I think that's really going to change a lot about and just the overall network in general.
So, what is it actually, and why is it so important?
Yeah. So, you know, this is something that like, I think like, you know, there's this chat and I saw this message from somebody. It's like, you know, everyone kind of gives me like a different definition of what stake weight quality of service is, you know, because everyone kind of interprets it differently, right? But like, let's talk about like the high level idea of stake weight quality of service is that like, you know, if you look at the amount of like traffic that comes into a validator, you know, like when they're a leader is absolutely insane. It spikes like crazy. You know, like a validator could be using, I don't know, like 100-300 megabytes a second of bandwidth. All of a sudden when like you're about to be the leader or are the leader, like you can spike up to like, you know, 1-2 gigabytes a second, right? There's just like, you know, there's so many bots and, you know, like, you know, ARB traders and, you know, or, you know, people mining ore and things like that that are just kind of like, yeah, right. You know, like just like, you know, trying to like avoid going through an RPC, you know, and just going directly to like a validator and, you know, things like that. And, you know, the idea here is that, you know, and then like there's a lot of issues in the validator client that, you know, like I was actually listening to your episode with Ben and, you know, he was talking about some of them. But yeah, the validator client can really get overloaded. And there's kind of this like issue, you know, where the validator client doesn't do a great job of prioritizing the transactions that have the highest fee in it, right? Mm. And not everything can be solved by economics as well. So like, for example, with all like the amount of traffic that goes to a validator, right? Like you're kind of hitting system limits at that point in terms of like, you know, I mean, listen, like every validator can go and buy a bigger server and, you know, we can all like, you know, I don't know, like come together and, you know, like build some connected cables to each other, you know, like, you know, push more bandwidth through things. But, you know, like eventually you hit some limit, right? And this idea of stake weight quality of service basically is that at a very high level, the more stake that some node has, the more bandwidth they can use of the active leader, right? Like to go like a little bit lower, right now, 80% of bandwidth is really reserved for staked connections and 20% is reserved for unstaked connections, okay? And really, like, let's say you're like the biggest validator on the network. That would mean Coinbase, right? That could mean that you could use like, you know, if you had 10% of stake, that, you know, it's like really high, you know, you could use 10% of that 80%. But what's really, you know, interesting now is that as a validator, you could set like a stake node, like There's a new flag in the Solana validator client and, you know, Gino validator, whatever, called stake node overrides. And what you could do is, you know, if you're running a validator and you're running an RPC node, you can say, okay, I want like you as my validator to think that this RPC node actually has like 10 million SOL of stake. Okay. Right. And, you know, if you're running like many different validators, you can go and do this on all of them. Right. And then like, essentially like your RPC node is able to, it can get transactions through faster or more reliably at a high level. Right. And so there's like a lot of like, you know, really interesting things that are happening that I think are like even changing the economics of validators as well, where, you know, some RPC nodes are pairing up with some RPC providers, I should say. And like, I don't have like any, you know, like inside knowledge in terms of like, you know, who's working on what, and, you know, I'm not, you know, that's cool. But, you know, there's definitely like, you know, conversations about this going on. And, you know, you're able to, you know, as a validator, you're also really able to sell access to the stake that you have as well, which is kind of interesting. And I think kind of has its pros and cons as well.
Okay. And okay, there's two questions. How do you actually, since you can sell your stake, would people just give this, why would someone give their stake away? And how can you attract that stake?
Yeah, so in the context of Stakeway QoS, or the like broader context, just like in, I guess your question was more about Stakeway quality of service, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Delegation of stake, I think.
Yeah, well, it's less about like, you're not selling like the delegation of stake, but you're selling acts like you, like an RPC provider, right? Oh. They want their transactions to get through as reliably as they possibly can, right? And this whole concept of stake weight quality of service is that the more stake that some node has in the network, like the more reliable their transactions can actually be, right? If an RPC provider works with a validator, they can go, that validator can go and override their RPC node so that their validator on the network thinks that their RPC node has, you know, X amount of stake, and that X can be whatever those two parties agree on, right? And because of that, like, you know, the RPC provider is getting a better guarantee that their whoever is submitting a transaction, which is their customers, their transactions are going to get through more reliably. And what the validator gets is really is money, right? So like, they're selling like, you know, that stake connection that they have in the network, really, you know, basically telling an RPC provider, like allowing their RPC provider to have like virtual stake, basically.
Virtual stake. So it's kind of like, it's kind of like an allowance, like an ERC-20 in a way.
Yeah, you know, like, and everyone kind of has different interpretations of like what stake weight QoS will actually do. But like from a pure technical perspective, like, and I should say like in terms of like a configuration point of view, right? Like that is really how it works. And yeah, it is like, you know, it is kind of like an SPL token or an ESR20 token or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, what I really hope is that one of my worries, and, you know, I've been pretty vocal about this, I think, has been, you know, like, I'm not a fan of like backroom deals and things like that. And there's no real transparency right now on what validator is working with what RPC provider and things like that. And it's really easy to go to like, you know, the L1 and say like, you know, the L1 should bake this in. And, you know, I don't think it has to be like, you know, I think we can, you know, like there's companies that are like already working on certain things to be able to sell like stake connections and things like that. But, you know, like I really want to see personally transparency in this. Right. And, you know, that's kind of the, that, you know, that's probably one of the two cons, I would say, in it, you know, that in my personal view, you know, and I think the second one really is that we're sort of creating fast lanes for some people as well. Now, it's not so much that, you know, like, so for example, like if an RPC provider is also selling access to their RPC nodes and things like that, you know, like that kind of makes it more fair. But it depends upon like which layer you're looking at things in terms of the overall effects it's going to have on the network.
No, but I feel like the backdoor deals is like a giant thing in Ethereum.
Yeah.
Because then you're just incentivized to do it. If you're not going to do it, someone else is going to do it, and they're going to control the network. It's kind of how it works right now. It's not really like a tech v tech anymore. It's more who can make the best BD deals and win with order flow.
Yeah.
That kind of just trumps engineering.
Agreed, man. Yeah, I totally agreed, right? And, you know, there's a lot of people that like, there's definitely a camp that is against stake weight quality of service, right? And I totally get why. I can see it. And like the way I kind of think about it is that it kind of has its it's pros and cons, you know, because like the end of the day, like it's really easy to look at things from like a theoretical point of view right. and just be like, no, well, like Stakeway quality of service, like it has cons, so we shouldn't do it. Right. But then there's like this practical point of view that like, you know, Solana had major congestion issues. Okay. And yeah. we gotta do something, you know? So, you know, like, so that's kind of the way I look at it. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. Right. You know, like I think like in a fully conceptual world, like, something like a fee-based quality of service would be super ideal in the sense that like, okay, if you're, you know, if like no matter who the sender is, if you're willing to pay the highest fee, you should be like, you know, that should work out. And, you know, like ideally we get to some that point in the future. It's like more difficult to get to that point now though, as far as I understand. And, you know, there's people that can probably talk about that at a better level than I could.
Okay. And You mentioned it a fair bit ago, but you did DATA at a Kraken, right? Are you doing DATA now on Solana?
We are. You know, I would say, we definitely are. Sure. We don't have like as much rich data, but you know, like a lot of the data that like one of the projects I really like, and big shout out to them, is Jito Stakenet. So, you know, for example, if you were ever to look at Edgesol, you know, as a listener, we have a delegation strategy and all of our algorithm results are published to our website. You know, it's stake.ajuana.com/validators. And we look at a bunch of different data points. And you know, like not like it really like it's an algorithm to basically decide. It's not like an algorithm to pick out like who the best validator is. Right. It's more an algorithm that's like basically designed to help someone say like, where should I stake my soul to, right? So like, I want to make that point clear as well. But in your data point, we actually pull a lot of data from StakeNet. So what Jito does is they're actually collecting a whole bunch of data on validators. So, you know, that's like, you know, the number of vote credits they have, like their inflation commission, MEV commission, like their IPs, stored like an epoch by epoch basis. And we actually go and parse that data. And, you know, we have like a different, you know, we have like an algorithm, but like that's a lot of the base data. We gather that. We take like 10 epoch averages, sometimes like max adjust, and basically build this algorithm that helps decide like where it, like the Ajuana liquid staking pool should stake its soul to. So, you know, we are ingesting that data and doing like, you know, math and arithmetic right. on that. We want to actually help push more data there as well. And we will at some point. We're going to run some cranks as well. So, you know, we are doing some stuff with data there as well.
And with the liquid staking, how do you actually make... So a big thing that I've seen when I was getting into Solana is, you know, validators trying to compete for delegation of SOL. And they're like, oh, if you give me your SOL, we can give you a better APY yeah. than someone else. How do you actually convince someone to give you their soul for your validator over someone else? I guess like a perfect example is like Jito, right? They have like 60% of the network, 40 to 60% using their client. How do you, and it's kind of weird because like if you have proprietary information on your validator as well, which gives you the edge and you want people to use that edge without knowing what it is, how would you do that? So yeah, there's two questions there. It's like, how do you bring people over to get more APY, make it more convincing for them to give you the soul? And how do you share a validator code without leaking all your alpha?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so liquid staking is really changing on Solana right now. And I think a large part of it is due to Sanctum, who's doing some really cool stuff. But, you know, like I'll give a high level answer, then I'm going to dive deep on like some of the APY stuff, because, you know, like I think like to answer your question about how to convince stakers to stake to, you know, liquid LSTX versus LSTY, a big part of that is really APY. I mean, you know, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't. And you know, what's really interesting on Solana is that all of the LSTs, really besides like Marinade, I believe, are using the same liquid staking program, right? Which is like, you know, baked into SPL. And I'll share the same program, which is really awesome because, you know, it's been audited 9 times.
Right.
And, you know, like the more people use it, like kind of the bigger the security gets, and, you know, the more people right. are going to pay attention to it. And, yep. you know, it's really great. So like, you know, for example, like Edgesol shares the same program as Jito Soul, right? Like that's mm-hmm. awesome. There's like what a lot of validators and pools are doing, and I would say especially validators, is, you know, validators make money, and like the priority fees have been shooting up like crazy on Solana right now. You know, it's really started with a congestion, and you know, like this is like kind of before like people knew where the congestion issues were, but you know, as you can imagine, like people are like, all right, let me try submitting a higher fee, you know, and like all of a sudden fees go like super high. You know, validators get those fees, like, you know, a portion of them, 50%. What's like some of these single validator stake pools, like, and stake tokens are doing is they take a portion of their block rewards and put it into the reserve account of that liquid stake pool. And if you really think about like how a price of an LST, like the price, like how an LST should be priced rationally, it would be basically the total stake that's in the pool divided by the total tokens that are minted. Right? Like, you know, like in the context, like if you're looking at a pair of like, you know, like, let's just say like Jito Soul Soul, right? Like, you know, it should really like, if a, in a rationally priced market, the price would be, you know, like the total stake divided by the total tokens minted. Which what a lot of like stake pools and like especially like single validator pools are doing is what they're actually doing is they are going and taking some of their validator rewards, staking that, but without minting any more tokens. So what does that do? It makes the numerator go up and the denominator stay constant. You know, and then if you look at like the price of an LST, all of a sudden it's going up at a faster rate. And, you know, then like, you know, as a holder of that specific LST, you're making a higher APY. And then like APY of LSTs is like, you know, somewhat contentious. Like some people like to look at like return on delegation, which is more like at a holistic view in terms of like the APY of the validators that the pool is staking to. But it's also not entirely fair because you're holding, if like you're a, if you're a holder of an LST, like AKA a staker, and you're holding that LST and you can go and sell it for like, you know, 11% or 15% or whatever, then like the return on delegation method like isn't accurate and it's not fair to use that. There's another issue with like this whole APY thing where it's that because what I'm describing is that like, okay, you can put money into the reserve, go and stake that without minting more tokens. At one epoch, you know, like you could see like that APY jump really, really high. But as the pool gets more stake, it's going to take more for whoever's running that LST to keep that APY the same rate, right? Because they got to keep depositing more and more and more in. So like you can see, like some people might like, you know, on one epoch, you might have like, you know, 15%, like, you know, you might see like 15% APY, but then the next epoch, you might see 13%, right? And kind of the flaw with that method is that, you know, like, it, the number looks good, number goes up, and everyone loves number go up. But it's actually really hard to maintain that higher APY the more pool, the more stake the pool gets, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. How, and then, interesting. So is there any other way of doing liquid staking? Like, what if you create your own liquid staking? Is it similar to Lido or ETH?
You know, so I'm not as familiar with like the Ethereum stake pools, admittedly. So I can't comment like as deep on that one. Lido did have a stake pool on Solana, and like, technically it still runs. And
oh, it was people, oh, I'm just, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. They were not using the stake pool program, and like Marinade and Lido, as far as like I'm aware, they weren't using it just because like that program wasn't out yet, right? And like as you can imagine, like with someone like Marinade who has billions of dollars in TVL, like it's a pretty big ask to move everything over, right? In terms of, you know, like there's many different ways of doing liquid staking, and really like with Solana, like, you know, like this is like kind of more like the academia type definitions, right? Like there's methods where that like the price of the token goes up, and really like that's the method that like Solana is really using. And then like, you know, as far as I'm aware, and again, I can't talk like as deep on the weeds as this one, but like, you know, there's other methods where that, like, you know, the, like you can gather more of the LST as like you continue to stake over time, right? Almost all the LSTs, like, really, like, you know, because they're all using the same program, which is like the SPL stake pool program, it's really like, you know, anytime you deposit money into that pool, the staker gets those tokens back, and then that money will eventually go and get staked. But, you know, because it's staked, the pool itself is making rewards, right? So the number, like the amount of stake goes up, you know, the tokens doesn't necessarily go up like in a world if no one else staked like after that, right? And like, that's what makes the price go up, right? You know, and then like, you know, arb traders, you know, they're aware of this. They know that, you know, like, okay, like, you know, if the price isn't like priced rationally on the market, you know, I could always go and, you know, get like a native stake account back, you know, right. Like, and do all this like crazy stuff, you know. It's like that, that's kind of how they work. Like in terms of like, there's probably are ways of doing it differently that I'm probably not as familiar with now, but that's kind of the way the world works now.
Interesting. And one final question is, where do you see Solana actually going in the future? Judging by today and what's happening now, where do you see it going? And what do you think needs to be added to keep it going in that direction? Or does it need to pivot in any way that you think it's going in a bad direction? What needs to change?
Yeah, great question. I think there's like, I think there's technical answers, and I think there's like kind of like more business type answers that like, you know, like kind of like, conceptual, like, you know, viewpoints here, like moral views and things like that. You know, in terms of like technical things, you know, I think it's like a pretty big issue what validators are facing now in terms of just like all this spam that's coming in. And I don't want to say like necessarily spam, but, you know, like the amount of like transactions that comes through to like a TPU is just enormous, right? And what that leads to is different validators doing different things, because like, you know, a validator, like a block producer in general, is incentivized to make sure that they're making the most amount of money, right? And, you know, if you, like, as a validator, block producer, whatever, you know, you see that, okay, like I could go, you know, and like, okay, I'm seeing that like this particular arb trader is submitting like a number of duplicated transactions, like their fees are really low. You know, I'm not going to like, I might just firewall them off. Okay. That's fine. Like, I don't, you know, like, understandably why a block producer might do that. But, you know, I think the real issue is potentially that, you know, different validators might be doing different things. It's a really hard technical problem to solve because of the fact of just like how much volume actually comes through, right? And there are probably potential ways to solve this in the economic layer in terms of making sure that, you know, like bots aren't incentivized to just like absolutely spam as much as they possibly can. But I'd like to see kind of more standardization across different validators, you know, because right now a lot of validators are firing off people, like, you know, nodes or, you know, IPs, right? And like a real, like probably the most used method right now is that a validator will firewall off any node that's not in gossip from submitting a transaction to their TPU. Some might take it a step further and say, okay, I'm going to do that, but I might firewall off any node who doesn't have at least like 5K SOL stake, right? Some other validators might go and say, I'm just going to like analyze all the traffic, right? And I'm going to look at the IPs that like have been submitting transactions with the highest fees, and I'm going to like manually allow those. You know, I mean, like the possibilities are endless there, right? I'd like to see some more like standardization in terms, you know, because like, I don't love the fact that like everyone is doing different things, but it's everyone's right to do that. So like, you know, I'm not like criticizing anyone here, and, you know, yeah. I'm doing certain things as well. You know, and then in terms of like more the, you know, where I want to see Solana in terms of like overall ecosystem, I think it really comes down to trading. Just like, you know, the sandwiching, I think was really an issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, like that's probably like the biggest blocker to really getting institutions on chain. You know, why would some institution want to go on chain if they're going to get like sandwiched every time? Right. And, you know, I'd love to see that solved, but, you know, there's a lot of people working very hard on that. And that's a really difficult problem to solve.
100%. Well, hopefully sandwiching stops, which it probably won't, because, you know, blockchains. Yeah, is what it is. But man, Max, it's been a pleasure having you on. You've given a lot of insight into the world of DevOps and Solana QoS, managing teams, all the above. You know, it's been wonderful having you on. Great to meet you as well. This is the first conversation we ever had.
Yeah, so it's awesome, man.
It's in the books, in the record, history. Now we have some lore. But man, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time. And have a good one, fellas. GNGN.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Take care.